From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire House recently narrowly approved a so-called right-to-work bill, which places limits on how unions can collect dues. These measures have come up many times before in the legislature, but have never made it into law. Back in 2011, a right-to-work bill did pass both the House and Senate, but not by the margin needed to override then-Governor Lynch's veto. Meanwhile, this current proposal may not even make it to Governor Hassan's desk, as it appears stalled in the state Senate. Still, right to work is catching on nationally, with Wisconsin becoming the 25th state to adopt it. And the arguments heard there, both for and against, are being heard everywhere. It's a huge debate over the impact of right to work on a state's economy and its people. Today in The Exchange, revisiting right to work. We'll look at the issue inside the Granite State and outside, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio is Bob Sanders, longtime reporter for the New Hampshire Business Review. Bob, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Joining us from Georgia is Professor Barry Hirsch. He's the W.J. Ussery Chair of the American Workplace and Professor of Economics at the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies at Georgia State University. Professor Hirsch, nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And also joining us from D.C., Lydia DePillis, Washington Post reporter, focusing on labor. And Lydia, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
No problem.
Well, let's start with you, Professor Hirsch, if we could. Just what is right to work? Because there's some confusion about what that really means.
It's hard to explain right to work without first just briefly saying a little bit about how companies get unionized. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935 set up the basic machinery through which private sector jobs could be unionized. And the short story is simply that if a majority of workers in a workplace vote in a secret ballot election to be covered by a union, companies then have to negotiate with that union, and they either do or do not come up with a collective bargaining agreement. In 1947, Congress amended the National Labor Relations Act to allow states to pass right-to-work laws, and that doesn't change the basic machinery on how companies get unionized. What it does mean is that workers who are in covered union workplaces need not join the union. They need not pay dues. Currently, as you said, we have 25 states with right-to-work laws. Most of those were passed shortly after the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, but then in recent years we've gotten a few more. In those right-to-work states, most workers who are covered, somewhere on the order of 85% or so, choose to join the union and be a member even though they do not have to by law.
So, Lydia, on the ground, what does this mean for your average unionized worker and non-unionized worker? And by when I say what does it mean, just very practically in terms of the dues they have to pay or not pay.
So it really depends on how strong the union culture is within the company that in a state that's now become right to work. So if the workers in a union feel like they're well served and that they need to have a strong infrastructure in order to continue to collectively bargain and run legislative campaigns and all these things, then they may continue to choose to support the union voluntarily. There's lots of cases where they don't feel that way, or perhaps they need that money for other purposes. And so since maybe the majority of the people in the union are still paying dues, they choose not to, and the union weakens. And then people feel like they're not getting much for their money, so they stop to support it. And then it turns into this spiral whereby unions end up much weaker than they were before. So that's on the union side. And now, as we know, unions only represent about 11-12% of the population right now. So for everybody else, what does that mean? Well, it really depends. There's a lot of debates over the effect that right-to-work laws have on different states. We can kind of generalize and say that sometimes they lead to greater employment, but usually not the kind of employment that pays excellent wages. So it's good for business, or can be, but often workers have less bargaining power in that situation, so more of the gains from that economic growth tend to accrue to the owners of capital.
Well, definitely labor. Get into some of those basic arguments that we've heard in New Hampshire, that we heard in Wisconsin, that we're hearing around the country. But just remind us real quick, Bob Sanders, of the history of right to work in the Granite State. It's a long one.
Well, actually, we did have right to work back in 1947. We
really?
Were one of the states that went along. But in New Hampshire, and this is thanks to Dexter Arnold, who is a local historian and works with the AFL-CIO, we had it for 2 years. We did it a little differently. We had it so that the two-thirds would be able to, in a sense, override the right to work and have a closed shop.
And I don't really understand what that means. Can
that's
you
that actually
more,
I don't either. So maybe our professor out there can explain this. But from what I was told in the Taft-Hartley Act, which was the law passed in 47, didn't allow totally closed shops. So it was not legal. And anyway, because of that, it was repealed in 47. It wasn't replaced by a regular right to work law. And we haven't had one since. They've been trying to pass it for the conservatives since 79, and got close in 2011, which I can go into detail later. But each time it doesn't get by because there's a party in some position of power that prevents it.
It did come really close in 2011. I remember that. So it's interesting. So we had it very briefly, then it was repealed, and people have been debating it basically for 30 or 40 years here in New Hampshire. Just remind us really briefly, Bob, the basic arguments that you've heard on either side of this issue.
Well, there are economic arguments, but my belief is, and I think most people agree, that it's really a political question. I don't think it makes much of an economic difference. In New Hampshire, we have very low participation in unions, and I'll get into that more. But basically, the idea is that if your people have the individual rights to belong to a union, they shouldn't be forced. That's a conservative argument. And the more liberal argument is that the union shops majority rules. They bargain and for everybody, and so those people benefit, so they should have to pay the dues and not be able to get a, quote, free ride. So those are the basic arguments. But it comes down to basically union strength and union power and how much unions should have, and that's what I think is really at center of the debate.
Okay, a lot more questions for all of you, but let me also invite our listeners to join us with their questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions, comments, thoughts on right-to-work laws and how they've evolved here in New Hampshire and around the country, with 25 states now having these laws. You know, as we talk about the impact, Professor Hirsch, you wrote recently in the New York Times that both sides exaggerate the effects of right to work. Give us a little bit more on that, please.
I think that's the case. First of all, the idea that proponents make that having to join a union is coercive, the idea that you don't fully agree with the union, I don't have any sympathy with that argument. In our everyday life, in the private sector, we join clubs, condo associations, et cetera, and we pay for a collective good even if we don't fully agree with how that money is being spent. Of course, in the public sector, we pay taxes when we don't agree with exactly how that money is being spent, where we haven't voted for the politicians who make those decisions. I don't see any difference with respect to unions in the workplace. Indeed, if anything, we have more control within the workplace over whether we're represented. Union workers vote for their leaders. They have to vote and approve each contract. So again, the idea that this is overly coercive, I think, is a bit silly. That said, note that on the idea of the free rider problem, workers with right to work in a right-to-work state, you still have the same rights and are covered by the same collective bargaining agreement that members are. Again, I don't see this as a big deal. Most workers voluntarily join the union and pay dues when they're covered, even if they don't have to. The one area, and we can talk about this later, where I think right to work does really have some salience is with respect to how firms use that as a signal for a favorable business climate.
Sort of a marketing tool.
Yeah, absolutely. It's clear a lot of companies do that, and there is reasonable evidence out there that right-to-work states trying to hold everything else constant do tend to attract more jobs and have had somewhat higher employment growth.
All right. And I definitely
As mentioned before, those may tend to be lower-wage jobs and may not be the types of jobs a state necessarily wants. But it does attract businesses.
Okay, and that's the economic argument that I definitely want to dig into with all three of you. But let's go to our listeners, too, hear what they think. And Tim is joining us from Rye. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So this issue's been on the news lately, and it's been in social media. And just this weekend, I saw a meme on Facebook, and it said that 8 out of the 10 states with the highest poverty rate in the country are right-to-work states. Well, one of my friends asked me what the other two was, and I went online and I got the statistics for poverty rates for every state in the country and the District of Columbia, and I discovered, and I'm quite proud to tell you, that New Hampshire has the lowest poverty rate of any state in the United States. So that said, and taking note of the correlation between right-to-work states and poverty, I really, even though we're a very conservative state, for some reason we've never enacted this thing, and I don't see any reason to do it now.
Okay, and we will dig into some of that data, poverty rates, wages, and so forth after a short break. Tim, thank you for calling in. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the debate over right to work, both here in New Hampshire and around the country. 25 states now have right to work laws with the passage in Wisconsin recently. Give us a call with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Professor Barry Hirsch. He's at Georgia State University. Also Bob Sanders, longtime reporter for New Hampshire Business Review, and Lydia DePillo, Washington Post reporter focusing on labor. And Lydia, following up on Tim's call, and Tim, thank you again for calling in. He's digging into the data. He's saying, look, New Hampshire is not a right-to-work state. We have a very high income level here in the state. So he's saying, basically, right-to-work is, we shouldn't go there. What do we know about the connection between right-to-work and average wages?
Well, I think Barry's right in that it's not going to have a gigantic effect either way, but the research that we have, the best that we have, and again, there's also not a ton of data in really recent years, but what we can see is that states do use their right to work status as a marketing tool, and that does matter to some companies. So you may see additional jobs, but part of the argument for passing a right to work law is that decreased unionization lowers labor costs, which is code for saying that lowers wages. So that means less pay for both union and non-union workers. And so if you want an economy that depends on consumers or that has a healthy consumption base, then maybe that's not the greatest thing for your economy. So it's hard to say, though, because, you know, the state with the highest unemployment rate and the state with the lowest unemployment rate happen to both be right-to-work states. So there's a lot of other factors at play here.
That's interesting. So it's oversimplified, Lydia. There's so many other factors that determine the state of an economy and how much people are paid.
For sure.
What do you think, Professor Hirsch? Do you want to jump in on that?
I agree completely. I mean, these are correlations. If you go back to 1947 and when states started passing right-to-work laws, it was obviously states with very few union workers in it, and that tended to be in the Southeast in particular, which were relatively poorly developed, low-income states and high-poverty states, and then a few Western states. So, again, right to work isn't being assigned randomly out there, so these correlations are just correlations and not causal effects.
You know, I wanted to ask you about New England, Bob Sanders, because even though this has been big in the South and in some Midwestern states, especially with the passage in Wisconsin, what about New England?
There's no New England states that have right to work. And New Hampshire was probably their best bet, and that's why it came so close in 2011. We used to have a higher union rates than the rest of the region. It was up to 24% in 64. That's as far as I go back. But people think it was even higher in the 40s and 50s. It's now down to 10%. It's the lowest rate in New England. Basically, it's most of the unions in New Hampshire are public employees. And that's why this is more political. It's not most companies coming to New Hampshire are not going to be dealing with unions unless they're big companies that are regional, like Fairpoint or something. And so why would it be an issue to any company? I know the business groups here, they support right to work, but there's no oomph in it. They're not really pushing it. There's lots of things more important: workers' compensation, wage issue to some degree,
energy costs,
and energy costs. Yeah, this whole thing is like a lot of even Republicans think of it as a distraction. It's really more a political and ideological debate here in New Hampshire than a real economic one.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Mark. And Mark, thank you for joining us. He says, unions began as well-intentioned and worker-friendly. Today, he says, the union juggernaut sucks the life out of workers with fees and dues. Now they are political and help ruin our economy. Their greed has driven businesses out of the country because they cannot compete. Look what they have done to the public service sector and the education system. Mark says they are parasites. You know, without commenting on the parasite comment, Professor Hirsch, what do you think about this idea that, you know, unions have not been good for the economy? Start out as well-intentioned, as Mark says, but today, no.
I think one has to clearly distinguish between the private sector and the public sector. Currently, about half of all union members are in the private, half in the public sector. The private sector now is below 7% unionized. Over the long run, there's been this gradual decline in unionization. A lot of it simply has been structural shifts in jobs, increased globalization and competition. I think it is fair to say, I certainly wouldn't use the same adjectives, but it is the case that unions raise wages and benefits for workers, but to the extent that that's not fully offset by higher productivity, that leaves unionized companies at somewhat of a competitive disadvantage. So there's been this kind of slow deterioration over time where you've had less growth of unionized companies, and much of the, you know, new companies are born non-union for the large part, and unions have had difficulty organizing new companies. So there has been this competitive aspect to it over time. I wouldn't just blame unions per se. It's the overall labor relations environment within a company. In some unionized companies, they have excellent relations between management and unions, but in too many, they do not. And I think mutual blame can go there. You know, management in general tends, in the U.S., tends to be very resistant to unionism. Unions basically formalize the governance structure, take away management discretion, and most management of U.S. companies prefer not to be unionized.
You know, something that Bob Sanders said earlier before caught my interest, and I wanted to ask you about it too, Lydia. You know, the percentage of unionized workers is so low in New Hampshire and overall these days. Does it really even matter if a state is right to work or not? I mean, at some level, given that it's only about 10%, does it have a broader impact?
Well, you could say that it matters if you want to undertake significant organizing campaigns, because a right to work environment is very difficult makes it very difficult to organize. So if you want to build union power, then it's an obstacle. In a place like New Hampshire, you guys feel pretty good about your economic state. Then it sounds like it's not going to make a big difference. So I think that it's more of an obstacle in those large southern states where lots of low-wage workers, where people see the potential for a union to do some good in allowing them to organize and collectively bargain for higher wages. So that's where I think the greater impact is. And it certainly might have a big impact in more heavily unionized places like Michigan, which went right to work in 2012. And we'll see what happens as a bunch of contracts expire because the law doesn't apply until they have those new contracts in place.
Yeah. And by the way, Lydia, I was surprised to learn that Wisconsin was right to work. I think of that as sort of the ultimate union state with the auto companies there.
Well, sure. And it was just a couple weeks ago that the bill actually passed and was signed by the governor. And Bob said something interesting before, too, about actually, it was Professor Hurst, sort of separating those public sector and private sector, because Governor Scott Walker initially went after public sector workers and stripped them of their right to collectively bargain, which had a really detrimental effect on their power. And he is now campaigning on that in his drive for the presidency.
In New Hampshire, yes.
Right, and Iowa and all those other early primary states. And so for him, it's an image thing. It's like, I took on these powerful unions and I'm getting your money's worth as a taxpayer. So when you talk about something being more political than really economic, I think that really rings true in the Wisconsin case. As hard as all the unionized folks tried to beat that back, they couldn't surmount a Republican legislature and a Republican governor who was determined to make it happen.
Yeah, Bob, go ahead. You want to jump in there?
Well, in terms of the politics, I think one person told me that this is really an attempt to stick it to the union, actually particularly teachers' unions, because a lot of the bills that are being passed are exempt police and fire, or that's sometimes a last-minute amendment because those are more conservative unions. It's a liberal teachers' union with their power that they kind of want to get after. And when you have right to work, people don't pay dues. They have less money, and that helps them, because that's less money that they can give or use in campaigns.
Well, that's interesting. So our Facebook comment person, Mark, did specifically talk about the teachers' union. So you're saying some of these bills in New Hampshire, including this one this year, exempt police and fire.
There's an amendment about it. I don't think that's been passed, so I'm not quite sure. There's several right to work bills, and there's both houses, both the Senate and the House. So I haven't been keeping track of exactly
but
each one.
But that's come up before. Yeah,
yeah, that's basically one attempt. But this in terms of it being political, in 2011, we had a very conservative kind of a Scott Walker type, but he was in the Speaker of the House, Bill O'Brien, who really pushed right to work. And it was a very narrow vote, and he kept on changing the vote so he would get enough votes, because we have 400 people, and a lot of times people don't show up. So he wanted to get it when the right people showed up. And eventually, after several votes, it was vetoed, and it fell short of overriding the governor's veto by 12 votes. That was kind of the closest we've ever gotten. This year, it's going to pass the House probably. It did pass the House, but the Senate, it was 12-12, didn't even pass. Chance of getting it over a veto, which is going to happen, is absolutely nil. But it is the conservative wing of the Republican Party that's been pushing right to work. It's not been really the business groups. It's on their, list of priorities, but they put it there, but they don't really push it.
Interesting.
Workers' comp was much more important this year than right to work.
Let's take another call. This is Travis in Concord. Hi, Travis. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Early in my career, I was an engineer, and I joined the union because it's something that I believed in. But then I saw people's positions and certain people protected who probably should not have been protected in the public sector. So I understand the comment that the Facebook poster made about parasites. But that being said, I have another kind of unique experience I'd like to share. I've actually traveled overseas quite a bit, and I've worked overseas as well, in Taiwan specifically. And after going there, I realized that the thing that makes the United States special and makes the United States a nice place to live is that we've had this tradition of labor rights dating back to the 20s and the 30s, and maybe even the 40s when that right to work legislation first passed. They don't have that in Taiwan. They don't have that in Asia. They don't have that in the rest of the world. And so what's happened is where the labor markets saturate, workers really basically have no rights. They have no benefits. They have no wages that they can even live on. In Taiwan, people live with their parents until they get married and even after because they just can't afford to move out.
Yeah, we're sort of hearing that in this country now, aren't we, Travis?
Pardon?
We're sort of hearing that in this country too, right? More and more young people living in mom and dad's basement.
That's exactly true. And as the labor markets become more saturated and as those labor markets de-unionize, I think the future is going to be fairly grim.
Well, it's interesting, though, Travis, you know, given that you did see some problems with unions when you were a member. So what's the middle ground, or what do you think?
Well, I don't have the solutions, but
yeah.
I think, you know, initially I was disillusioned with the union. I joined because I thought it was a good thing, and I regretted joining after that. But having seen the other side of the coin, I think they do more good than bad.
All right. Well, Travis, thank you very much for joining us. Do you want to comment on that, Professor Hirsch?
Yeah, I think one always has to be a little careful about generalizing from, you know, fairly narrow situations. But, you know, that's certainly a common argument. The distinction I would make is, again, going back to kind of public versus private sector. In the private sector, you really see substantial differences, I think, between union companies and non-union companies in terms of how formalized they are and the type of governance they have. In the public sector, less so. Even in non-union states, say as in Georgia or other southern states, you have within government, you have civil service. It's very formalized. And you have a lot of protection for workers that you wouldn't have in the private sector. So this distinction between kind of union public sector governments and non-union personnel rules in government, I don't think that difference is all that substantial.
You know, you've written, Lydia, just picking up on what he says about, you know, he sees good and bad in unions. You've written, I think it was you, who said that unions could actually benefit from right to work because it forces them to be more adaptive to members and prospective members. The idea being that they have to work a little harder for that membership. Again, Lydia, I'm not sure if you wrote about that or if you were just quoting someone else, but I'd love your thoughts there on the idea that some people say unions can benefit from right to work, kind of lights a fire on them to be more adaptive and responsive.
Sure, I did write a bit about this, and it's from things that I've heard from folks in unions trying to see a silver lining in it. Because, you know, the comment from the caller, I think, is really very insightful in that there are some unions that through the 80s and 90s got complacent. They were protected within their industries. And then all of a sudden, a lot of economic changes happened and right to work laws took effect. And they lost that power and they didn't have the allegiance of their members. And so there's a school of thought out there that says right to work laws make unions work for the allegiance of their members, and that even when you're in a right-to-work state, going to someone and saying, look, this is entirely your choice, but we think it's a good one, and, like, look at all these people in your workplace who've decided it's a good choice. Nobody's going to force you to pay anything. That's an easier pitch to make to people who are skeptical of the whole idea than, you know, if the majority of your workplace votes for the union, then you have no choice but to pay to support it.
Well, it's kind of – yeah, go ahead, Professor Hirsch. Yeah.
I would agree completely with Lydia on that. I was making a kind of a related argument in my New York Times piece, and again, you can think of that as kind of an escape valve for the small number of workers who do strongly oppose the union. You know, that gives them an out, and I do think it's speculative, but I think it does make unions more responsive to their membership. If I could go back to an earlier point, and again, this is this public-private distinction, and Bob talked about this a little bit earlier. We keep using the number that about 10% of workers in New Hampshire are unionized. That's correct, but If you look separately at the private sector, where most jobs are, only about 3 to 4% of workers are unionized. So it's very tiny. In the public sector, about half of all workers are union members. And if you take all the total union members in New Hampshire, two-thirds are public sector workers. So there's just very little private sector unionism in New Hampshire. And what that also means is, in terms of attracting jobs to New Hampshire, when companies look at New Hampshire, they really don't face a high probability of having, say, their new establishment unionized if they come to New Hampshire. So I'm not sure that this signaling really would do much for New Hampshire. I agree with others saying that the motivation here is really political.
So using it as a marketing tool, it's almost moot, you're saying, Professor Hirsch, in this state, because there's such low private sector unionization anyway.
Exactly, at least for those businesses that are somewhat discerning. You know, some businesses may simply start out and say, okay, I'm only going to look at right-to-work states. And that happens, but if it's someone's really serious about where they want to be, they can look at New Hampshire and see that they're not threatened by unionization.
Okay. We will talk more after a short break, and we'll also take your questions and comments. Emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Right to Work, its history here in New Hampshire, and why more states are adopting these laws. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Bob Sanders, Professor Barry Hirsch, Lydia DePillis, let's go right back to our listeners. Jason's joining us from Concord. Hi, Jason. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Since you're talking about how this is a very political issue, and I completely agree, I just wanted to point out that in New Hampshire in 2014, New Hampshire One did a story about this, and it was on a blog called Miscellany Blue. The National Right to Work Committee funneled $25,000 in out-of-state contributions to state Senate candidates in an effort to get a veto-proof majority in the state Senate. And they formed five separate PACs in the state so that they could circumvent the campaign contribution limits. And what they technically did was not breaking the law. They very much violated the spirit of the law. And it shows that they don't have the support in the state to raise the money to elect the people that they wanted, so they had to find a way around the contribution limits. And I think it just shows that just like the Republicans in the Senate blocking the appointees to the National Labor Relations Board, this is all part of an effort to continue the decline of union membership. And where right to work is really dangerous is it's very difficult to organize a workplace as it is. If everything was equal, it's very difficult to organize a workplace. And what we've seen is a stacking the deck against the workers at every step of the way. And I think this is just the natural extension of it.
Well, I want to ask everybody about this. Thank you, Jason, for calling in. Bob Sanders, so he's saying the National Right to Work Committee, one of these big national groups that play politics in all the states on all types of issues, funneled $25,000 into New Hampshire to push in favor of right to work. What does this say to you about the sort of state dynamics surrounding right to work and the role that these national groups play?
Well, it just goes, it's a national issue. It's not a local issue. When we're talking about those statistics, we got to even go dig a little deeper. I don't have the statistics, but just think in those private sector workers at 3 or 4%, a lot of the bigger unions and where most of the unions are on places like Fairpoint, PSNH, Unitil, and even the construction trades. All these are not people who are going to move or not move to New Hampshire because of right to work. We're not talking about factories here or plants or high-tech companies. It's really not an issue here. There are much more important issues that people are really fighting at that really make a difference. I think workers' comp was a very big one here. Just people are up in arms about having a fee schedule to control medical costs. The business groups are really pushing that, at least some of them. There's a big issue over paid a family leave, where you have some kind of insurance policy like unemployment insurance that maybe workers and companies pay into that allow family leave, social issues like social media, you know, in terms of people having a right to withhold their Facebook passwords, you know, more modern stuff. And hours. I mean, people are talking about minimum wage, which is another issue that goes year in, year out, and year in. And people right now, a lot of people need hours, not wages. It's not a matter of if you have $9 or $10 an hour when you are – it's a difference between 15 and 25 hours a week or getting called in for 2 hours and – you know, or 3 hours and not getting the rest of the day. So these are the kind of issues that affect people's real lives, both workers and businesses, that people are fighting over.
Very interesting. So again, given your conversations with businesses and workers groups and so forth, a lot of them just don't seem to care that much about right to work anymore.
No, it will be played out because it is on the national agenda, but I don't think it really means anything.
Well, locally. And that relates to Jason's call. Jason, thank you very much for calling in. You know, both of you, maybe you first, Lydia, what do you think about that point that, you know, people today care about, quote unquote, more modern stuff, that right to work is just feeling kind of stale?
I don't know if I'd call it modern. I mean, I think we've argued about wages and scheduling for decades, but they certainly are broader issues that matter. But the thing is, unions play on those issues, right? They're often the ones out fighting for higher minimum wages and better paid family leave laws. And at least now, right, now that they realize they need to make themselves relevant to a broader section of the population. So that – and I think why we're seeing a renewed push for right-to-work laws, even though unions have been – like the term big labor has never been as much of a misnomer as it is now – it's, you know, on the one hand, it's because they have been historically Democratic donors, so that it's advantageous for Republicans to weaken them as much as possible. And the National Right to Work Committee, which was mentioned, is active in all of these states right now across the country and in partnership with something called the American Legislative Exchange Council, which works with state legislatures and has been very successful. Anyway, so it's true that there are a lot of issues that are more important on the face of them to your average worker, but grinding unions into the dust is something that will affect those issues as well.
Does right to work, Lydia, quote unquote, grind unions into dust? Or, as we talked before the break, does it make them kind of step it up and make them better?
You know, it can have both effects, right? I think what historically we found is that it hasn't been good for unions. Like, there's just no way around that. But there are different ways in which you can strengthen worker bargaining power, even in the atmosphere of right to work laws. And there's also places where unions have remained strong despite them. So if you take a look at Nevada, for example, the hospitality unions in Las Vegas are still growing and have done a lot of good for the housekeepers and casino workers that they represent.
And Professor Hirsch, to you, I'm interested in our caller Jason's comment about, again, national money coming into New Hampshire to influence the right to work debate. Now, in fairness, we see national money on all sorts of issues coming into state legislatures in an effort to influence lawmakers on those issues. But what have you seen? What about the impact of national money and this movement we've seen toward right to work?
Yeah, I don't have any particular expertise on that area, but I certainly agree with what others are saying, that this is mainly a political issue. As everyone knows, labor unions tend to support almost exclusively Democratic candidates, and the desire to lessen union revenues, I think, is the impetus behind right to work laws. In almost every state where these have passed, states like Wisconsin, Michigan, it's where you've traditionally had a strong tradition of unions. and industrial states, but you've only gotten right to work being passed when you've had both a Republican legislature and a Republican governor that would not veto those bills. So that's what's new about all of this.
Here's a Facebook comment from Brian, who says, I would love to know why employees who do not wish to pay union dues are still entitled to union-negotiated benefits. Brian says it seems like a win for both sides to allow employees to completely opt out of union obligations and benefits if they wish. This is a good question, one that I had too. Thank you, Brian. Lydia, what about that? So right now the problem for unions is that even those employees who don't pay dues still get the benefits. Have any unionized workplaces said, okay, this contract only is going to cover those who are members and the rest of you, you're kind of on your own?
So correct me if I'm wrong, Professor Hirsch, but I believe that's actually illegal.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. If you form a union, you have the obligation to represent everybody, and that contract represents everybody and covers everybody in the bargaining unit. And we're starting to see arguments about changing that, which could be good for both workers and unions. If you say it's something called minority unionism. And it's a little bit scary for unions because they think that's a route to company unionism, where you have just a small section of workers and they are very accommodationist. You see this in other countries. But it would allow the unions to focus on and advocate for specifically those who make the deal to support them and pay for those services. And you might have heard of this fight down in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Well, we're starting to see something like this because the United Auto Workers did not win a full election there. But Volkswagen very much would like to see some sort of representation, which is unusual. And so what they've done is gotten to a certain level of membership, and they are not at a collective bargaining state yet, but they are talking to the company on behalf of their workers, and they may be recognized at a certain point. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you for the Facebook comment. Here's an email from Isaac, who says many employers and unions have negotiated something called an agency fee, which covers the cost of contract negotiation and enforcement, but not union political activities, so that non-members do not freeload. Right-to-work laws prohibit agency fees, which means more and more members choose to freeload, and union resources and effectiveness rapidly diminish. Isaac says he's been a member, officer, and employee of several unions. He says, I would be fine with right-to-work for less laws if they also eliminated duty of fair representation. What do you know about this, Professor Hirsch? Again, as we sort of focus on middle ground or other alternatives beyond this sort of protracted debate over right to work.
Right. There's a nuance even where you have do not have right to work laws. When someone is a union member, they must pay the so-called association fees, but are not required to pay the part that goes for political purposes. And, you know, that's been decided by the Supreme Court. The implementation has varied a lot from administration to administration, and that affects relatively few workers. That very few workers would, do that, and it's usually not that easy for them to do it. I don't think we have any really particularly good data on that, but your caller is exactly right that is allowed.
You know, we all talked earlier about this movement and how it's been growing, including the recent passage in Wisconsin. Bob Sanders, what do you think? Is there a tipping point where most states are right to work, and so the states that aren't, you know, feel pressure to become right to work because everybody around them is right to work? I realize New England is kind of a special case. Go ahead, Bob, and I want to hear from everybody else too.
Well, I think, as I said, New Hampshire is probably the best bet to get a foothold in New England for right to work. And this election is not going to happen, but if a Republican gets in the governorship and they hold both houses, it's a good chance that it will pass in New Hampshire, if anywhere in New England.
So Massachusetts, so Vermont, Maine, they're not going to do this.
Just keep on putting the money in, and maybe eventually it will pay off. That's
because the last time it came close, it passed House and Senate, but Governor Lynch vetoed it, and there wasn't the margin there.
No, they didn't have the margin. I think we need they need to capture the governorship in order for that to happen. But again, I don't see that changing very much in New Hampshire, one way or the other.
What about the tipping point idea, Lydia? What do you think about that?
I mean, it's not there are still states that will forever support the union security is the flip side of that. But I think it's true that the calculus changes, right? So as states start to become islands, like in the Midwest, we're looking at Minnesota, Illinois. In the South, we're looking at Kentucky, West Virginia.
Those are sort of the holdouts in those regions.
Right. A bunch of those have had in the past right-to-work laws in play. West Virginia, now that's the biggest fight. Illinois, they still have a Democratic legislature, so they'll probably stand strong against it. But who knows? The Democrats haven't been particularly great for unions there. So if they feel it's a competitive disadvantage relative to their neighbors, they might feel additionally compelled to pass a law like that. But at the same time, there's a lot of advantages that a state could have that prove attractive to businesses. Like as Bob was talking about, there's a whole lot of education matters to them, infrastructure matters to them, all kinds of taxes. So the idea that right to work would all of a sudden make you competitive when you hadn't before is flawed economic thinking.
Yeah, that's what you said in your piece again for the Times, Professor Hirsch. You know, arguments are exaggerated on both sides. What do you think about this tipping point idea that the pressure becomes too great?
Yeah, I agree with the punchline that it's not going to happen, but I think it's a fun thing to think about. If, in fact, the main motivation for right-to-work laws was to attract businesses, and if, in fact, this really was a strong determinant of that, then I think you would see it tipping toward virtually all right-to-work, because as states did not adopt it, they would be at an increasing disadvantage since so many others had it. Again, I don't think it's the economic motivation that's driving this, or that right to work is that good a signal. If what's driving the impetus now for more right to work is the political motivation, then the only way that we would get a tipping point would be to have virtually all Republican legislatures and governors, and I certainly don't see that happening either.
Well, and you already said, Bob Sanders, that New Hampshire probably won't go this route this year. And New England, you sound pretty confident, is not going to go for right to work for a long time. What about the rest of the country, Lydia? What's the next state that might become right to work?
So West Virginia is still a fight. Illinois is, you know, as I mentioned, is you have a very anti-union governor. He just got elected there, Bruce Rauner. I don't think he'll manage to get to right to work. He will take on a number of fights before that. New Mexico is a place where it has been targeted. And I believe Maine has also been targeted, and there's a conservative governor there. But, you know, it's hard to say. Like, they haven't lost yet, just like they really definitely lost the Wisconsin fight quite a while before it happened.
Professor Hirsch, what do you think?
I agree with that completely. And again, I don't know enough about the individual states to make a prediction there.
All right. All of you, thank you very much for being with us. Lydia DePillis, it was good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Lydia DePillis, Washington Post reporter, focusing on labor. Professor Hirsch, good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome.
That's Professor Barry Hirsch. Again, he's a professor of economics at the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies at Georgia State University. And Bob Sanders, good to see you.
As usual, I love to be on this show.
Bob Sanders, longtime reporter for the New Hampshire Business Review. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Dylan Morrill. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.